Welcome back to the podcast, Travis Boughton. How's it going?
Hey, Jeff. It's going well.
Good to have you back on. I wanted to talk to you again about your most recent Stone Glacier film. Took place in here at Southeast Alaska, the Bear Hunt. I guess how do you sum up such a great trip? If you haven't seen the YouTube film, it's awesome. And sometimes you get this. It's always kind of the same. You're on the bear flats and you see a bear and you shoot the bear, but this one was truly unique. So how would you summarize this without giving too much away?
Man, that's hard to put a summary to all of that. But I'd say it was my first experience for Southeast Alaska and then doing a bear hunt. So it was all new to me. So I don't really know how it always goes. I just had a little bit experience from watching videos and talking with Jesse and my brother, but it was just good buddies getting together, planning to do a spring bear hunt, hopefully find a bunch of bears on the coastline. The plan was to kill them with bows, and our main goal was to at least call in one bear and shoot it with a bow and do some fishing in our free time, and pretty much just take in the whole Southeast Alaska hunt from a boat experience. And it turned out, you could ask for a better trip with a better group of guys. I mean, it was just remarkable.
Yeah, your brother went up there last year, and did he tell you about what to expect, or how did the planning for it go?
Yeah, so Zach went up there with his buddy Brandon, and he was just going to go capture that hunt and wanted to just experience it and hang out with Jesse and Dan. And when he came back, he was like, dude, it's so cool. Just the whole experience of being on a boat, fresh seafood, lots of bears, big bears, getting stalks, just beautiful country. Just a surreal experience. He's like, you have to come up if we go back up again. And so I think he had let me know. I can't remember, I guess, when non-resident tags and just planning, I guess, starts. But he had let me know that him and his coworker, Lyle, were going to get tags and go do the hunt again spring of 23. And he wanted to see if I wanted to come make a film, shoot some content, shoot some of the new gear. And it was not hard to convince me. I was like, yes, I absolutely want to do that. And then just to be able to hang out with Jesse Knock again, we kind of have just a good chemistry. And he's, I would call him a good friend of mine now. The planning started well in advance. I can't remember the exact time frame, but we had a lot of phone calls ahead of time because we wanted to just maximize marketing dollars for Stone Glacier, because that's definitely not a cheap trip. Just the logistics of flying up there, groceries are seem exceptionally expensive.
Yes, indeed.
Renting some gear and then just, everything that's just associated with a hunt like that.
When people talk about how expensive it is, it's really expensive here in Ketchikan, but it's a whole different level over on Prince Wales in some of those rural areas. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. Even one island away, how much better it is, how much fresher the produce is, how much cheaper everything is. But you get in some of those remote areas and it just ends up being just brutal.
But, yeah.
So you went up last year with Jesse on the caribou hunt, and you didn't know him before that hunt. Is that right?
Yeah, that was our first time meeting and hanging out.
So this time when you were down Southeast, were you kind of maybe surprised a little bit by how different the terrain was? You kind of did that iconic caribou interior hunt, and then Southeast was it like, oh, this is just like Varsity or Oregon Plus or anything like that? Or did you still get that same sense of brutal wildness?
It's just, they're just two different worlds. I mean, Southeast compared to the rest of, well, Alaska up north. I kind of like knew what to expect, but yeah, it's really hard to like explain like what your experience is going to be until you go and do it. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely got its own ruggedness. I mean, you still see those like alpine peaks where, you know, blacktail hunting, I'm assuming, is happening. And then the forests are just crazy rainforest, thick in some spots, very thick. But yeah, I mean, it's rugged. It's just rugged in its own sense.
How was that on the filming equipment? Obviously, you've been in some rugged terrain before. So was it a unique challenge to shoot in Southeast?
I mean, we were prepared for it. We had kind of planned on it raining every day. We were fortunate that the beginning of our hunt, we had really, really nice weather. But yeah, the rainy days are always tough on camera gear. I always had a weatherproof, I guess, covering that I would keep on the camera. And then a lot of just like microfiber cloth to dry off any moisture that's starting to develop on the camera, and just hope that you don't have any crazy failures or fry any SD cards or anything like that. But yeah, everything went super well. And there was times where it was difficult, but overall, I'd say it's easier in a sense that we were able to bring more gear, you know, just hunting from a boat rather than like a backpack hunt. So it does make it a little bit easier when it's like, oh, I have a second camera body with me if this one fails, and like any lens I want to bring or pack on the boat is coming with me. And so you have a lot more, I guess, safety measures to make sure that you're able to capture everything regardless of what happens.
Yeah, when my wife and I were hunting in Wyoming, it was nice to have as much stuff as we could ever need or want in the car. Yeah. So all we got to do is get back to there. You know, you hike in a couple miles, you know, do whatever. But there's just no reason to not bring anything you could ever need. You do a fly out. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's not happening. But yeah, with a boat, it's that same luxury. But then you still get to get much further away from people because, you know, it's pretty remote when you get in those areas. Even the road hunting around there would be way better and easier than like a lower 48 hunt. But with that boat, it's just, as long as it's working, of course.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was nice not to have to like count batteries and cards ahead of time and pick the lenses I wanted to actually pack around with me, you know, on a backpack hunt. All those logistics are, for a camera man, is not as ideal.
Yeah. What kind of camera were you using?
So we had a Sony A1 and then a Sony A7S. It's like the version 2, the most latest.
And then A7S. What about for lenses?
We had like a wide angle 24 to 70, 80 to 200. I think we had like a 300 telephoto. And then a couple like primes. We had like an 85 and a 35 prime.
Mm-hmm. And then how often are you kind of looking at what the shot's going to be and switching between, or just like choose one for the morning, or are you just like there rapid changing out as things happen?
I mean, switching out depending on the situation. I mean, if it's like I'm trying to just document what's happening, say we're going in a stock or just trying to capture commentary or things that are actually happening firsthand, usually like a 24 to 70, because I'm able to just kind of capture most everything without having to be like, oh wait, I gotta switch lenses. But for certain shots, you kind of have an idea of what lens you're gonna need. Some of the stocks, it was like I'd hang back and I'd switch to, you know, like a long lens so I could zoom in and capture the shot without being there with the hunter as he's stalking. So I'm not a nuisance to the hunter. The bear's not going to smell me first and he's not going to see me. So it all just depends on the situation. You know, for in the skiff, usually like a wide angle, if I want to capture everything that's going on. And then I guess, yeah, we had an 85 millimeter macro. So obviously those shots are specific to what's going on, where like some of the shrimp or any of those really detailed like bear fur type shots. You know,
yeah, that fur shot was awesome. That's in the teaser, right? Yeah, that's real cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all that stuff was, you know, you have quite a bit of free time as a cameraman on those hunts. We didn't really hunt mornings. We usually hunted late morning, midday, all the way through the evening. It just tends to be the best time to see bears. Mm-hmm. So the morning I'd be up and just be like, what am I? I need to just start shooting stuff. And a lot of it was shooting macros or eagles flying by, or, you know, different weather, time lapses, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things about, you were talking about filming the stock. One of the unique things about the film was that it was so different in that the use of the call was a primary part of it. So many of the films or footage that you see about that is kind of cruising around on the beaches, seeing something on the grass flats, and then trying to get from the boat to shore, then making a stock. But the call was such a huge part of this one, which is super unique. I think it was your brother's shot where you get the bear coming into the call, like it's coming in with a sense of urgency. And then you were filming Jesse when that one came in and he shot it like 5 feet or whatever. Was that you filming both times?
So I filmed the sequence you were just talking about with Zach out ahead. Okay. Calling the bear that you could see on the beach. And actually when Jesse and Zach calling that bear and he shoots at like 3 yards, Zach was filming that.
Okay.
Because when he first went out on the boat and started hunting, it was going to be, you know, we have four hunters essentially. So Dan, Lyle, Jesse, and Zach. And Jesse was going to be up first and then Lyle. And so rather than one cameraman with three guys trying to go on stalks or whatever, we split up just to maximize our time and opportunity. And so Zach actually filmed the first couple days with Jesse until Jesse filled his tag, and then he was able to just focus on hunting. But yeah, he filmed that hunt or that kill. And it's funny because he's the one calling too. So he's trying to do multiple things all at once, which is not always ideal, but I mean, he's super well versed in doing all of it and doing it well. So he did a great job.
Yeah. That when you're the one that your brother shot, and going back to the calls there, like those calls, the drop shot call guys are so good because they're not into mass producing calls. Mm-hmm. They deal with, like music wood. So they have a good ear for the right pitches. It's not just a matter of putting the tape in there and then, you know, here's another one and let's sell it. Like they're really, really good. And those drop shot calls are super, super good. You can like the pitches, the air support, and then they're rugged too. I have a couple other ones that I've got that they fail. You can't just blow softly on it. The high pitched ones seem to just kind of like squeal in a non predatorial sort of way, but those things are so good. And it was really cool to see that be one of the main highlights, because I don't think a lot of people use the predator call a ton for a spring bear.
Yeah. The guys at Drop Shot Calls make a great call, and it was cool to we got to hang out with Ryan when we were up there, and he gave us kind of a tour where they make them and everything. But yeah, it's really cool that they the business they have, and it's primarily making those guitar tops out of wood. And then Ryan and his family wanted a really good blacktail call, and they just developed it out of their own needs. And the amount of detail they put into those calls, and then they test every single one to make sure it's, you know, making the perfect note, which they obviously know what it's supposed to sound like. And they don't send it out unless it's like perfectly tuned.
Yeah.
And then they're all like it's just cool. I mean, it's like a piece of art.
Yeah.
But it's also a call. And then it's even better that it's local there to Southeast Alaska to use those calls. Mm-hmm. And it's just crazy how well they work.
Yeah.
And Zach had one. He had bought one the year prior from those guys. And it works in Montana too. He's called and killed a couple bears now with that call. So
is there a lot of bear calling down there, or is it, spot and stalk? What's the bear program down there?
I'd say primarily people are spotting and stalk hunting, but Zach and I, we've always kind of had an affinity for calling in animals, and more specifically predators. We're big coyote hunters, and then we knew it was possible to call in black bears. I mean, you see people doing it, and we just started calling. I don't know. It's probably been 10 years now for black bears, because you'll get into areas in Montana where it's like, okay, there's bear poop all over this old log road. Like, I know there's bears in here, but you might not actually see one. And a lot of times you can set up and call. And I mean, we've had a pretty high success rate on calling in black bears and having it work. Whether they come in to, get a shot or not, that's a different story. But I think after you hit that specific date, which I would say is middle of May, until the end of bear season, so middle of June, when those fawns are starting to drop in Montana, it's a really effective tactic. And I think most people don't do it just because they don't have the confidence. And you kind of have to know, like, where do I set up? I mean, it's just like elk hunting, but I'd say a little bit more difficult, because you're not dealing with like a rutting animal that you're calling in to mate. It's strictly like an instinct to kill, to eat for bears. So
are you hunting areas that have territory that overlaps grizzly and black bears? And are you worried about calling in a grizzly bear, or are you mostly hunting areas that are kind of black bear areas?
I'd say primarily like 80% of the country hunt is mostly black bear country. We do hunt some that crosses over with grizzlies, and we call in those areas, but you definitely have to be a little more careful about where you're going to set up, and know that it's a possibility to call in a grizzly. We haven't called one in yet, or I haven't. And just got to make sure you can see your blind spots really well. Yeah. It is a little more nerve wracking.
Oh yeah. I can definitely imagine there are a couple times when I've heard some rustling in bushes when I've been calling during rut, and there's some black bear that are around. It's kind of in the area that's the black bears are down on the creeks, but we're hunting a muskeg that's not too far from the creek. And so I had some black bears more in like a curious sort of sense. You kind of hear them coming, but not straight up charge like in the film there. So being aware is always an important skill to have.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times we'll even call on black bears, and sometimes they're super quiet. And we've had bears come in super close, and you don't realize they're there until all of a sudden they bust and you hear a bunch of brush breaking. But yeah, you always have, when you're calling, you definitely have to be very aware.
Yeah. That's one of the, I kind of feel just disappointed in myself, because there have been times when I'm just trying to sneak through the woods and then I'll hear a bear bust almost behind me. So it's like, I didn't hear anything, and I'm being super, super quiet, and I'm just, absolutely in predator ninja mode. But then I don't notice a bear that's like, not even very far away, and it just waits for me to walk past it, and then it busts. I think, man, there's no way, had this been 200 years ago, that I would have survived. I would not have made it through natural selection. I got to be a little more observant than that.
Yeah. I feel like if you lived back then, you probably would be that way anyways.
Yeah, you kind of have to from a young age.
Yeah, just to survive.
Yeah. You got four kids, right? Is that right?
Yeah, four kids.
Yeah. My wife and I are expecting our first in September, so I got a couple dad questions for you.
Awesome, man. Congratulations.
Thanks. People talk about you enter this like parent bubble for 18 to 30 years or whatever. How have you and your wife managed like being able to be like engaged, good parents, and then also not, I don't want to say sacrifice, but like you can still be yourself and then also good parents. How have you managed that?
Yeah, it's a huge transition once you have kids. It's very hard, I would say. I don't think it gets easy. Even more so if you like are passionate about doing things like hunting or fishing. But I mean, we've definitely had to make sacrifices, and I mean, I've sacrificed a lot of time that I used to spend out in the woods, just to help support my wife, and to be there for my kids. Cause yeah, I mean, our oldest is, well, they're twins. They're almost 3.5. And yeah, it's just kind of a crucial point in a children's life to kind of be there, but also for your wife. You know, it's a hard time for a lot of women to have a child and have a lot of things change, and like their hormones change. Because even my wife, she dealt with some postpartum depression, and that was really hard on her. She didn't really know. Like, she was like, "What is this? Like, I don't know what's going on." And so yeah, I mean, I think just working as a team, and yeah, just being there for your kids' needs. Obviously, take the time you need to do some things for yourself so that you're able to have clear mental health. And also kind of for me, it's, you know, I have this like adventure cup that I need to fill. And so trying to find things to still, you know, seek that adventure and stay motivated. But also not take it to the extreme where my family, I guess, hates me for being gone so much. Like, what are your priorities? So, yeah, I think it's just setting your priorities and making sure that your family ranks pretty high and kind of putting everything on the back burner. And if you're able to go out and, you know, go hunting or fishing or do the things that you want, in your free time, I mean, then do it, but also just keep it within a reasonable amount or whatever that is for your family. It just depends on the person and the family and the situation. But yeah, you guys will figure it out.
Yeah. I've known some people, one guy in particular I worked with in California. He always talked about like his life before kids, and it sounded like he resented having kids so much because he had this fun and exciting life and he was fly fishing and he was doing all these things. But when he started talking about the now, oh, I haven't fished since I have kids. And there was like a pitch of anger. I was like, oh, that's not good. You know, it seems like the people who do it the best are the ones who are like, well, yeah, you know, I don't get to hunt or fish as like all the time, like I used to be able to, but having the responsibility and the, you know, opportunity to be a good dad is way worth the switch and or the alteration to the lifestyle.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think a huge part of it is like having like just getting your mindset right about having kids. And some people, you know, they'll look at it as a burden or talk about it as a burden. And I mean, you're kind of setting yourself up for failure. But it's like, there's nothing better than being able to have a kid or a child to raise and then to potentially be able to like share those things that you're so passionate about, like in that guy's situation, fishing or hunting, and being like, you know, not short-sighted. Like, yes, you may not be able to fish for a year, you know, whatever it is. But down the road, you got to look down into the future. You're raising a child. You want them to be exceptional, and hopefully you'll be able to share what you love so much with your child. And that is, like, the ultimate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know anything better than being able to, like, share things I love or am passionate for with either a friend or someone else, but even more so like my own family and children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Abby and I were talking about, cause we both like to hunt and fish and camp and all that stuff. And, some of my friends even before like the marriage, when like you're single in your 20s, it's like, do whatever you want mm-hmm. on your own schedule. And people say, well, that'll all end when you get married. And I was like, yeah, really hasn't. Like, she's just as excited about getting out and get after it as I am. So we're talking about camping with the kid, and I was like, well, yeah, we can camp. That'd be great. But what if the baby starts crying? And that's like mm-hmm. a predator call, right? we watched the film together. We know what happens when there's crying. And she's, my wife said, well, I'm sure a bear wouldn't respond to a baby crying in a tent the way it would Jesse does with a call. And I was like, yeah, probably, but maybe we'll wait until we don't have to rush. Maybe we'll wait until it's done crying to do some of the camping stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people could do far more than what they actually do with kids. I think if you're motivated and patient, like taking your kid from a young age to go try to like do a lot of the stuff that you guys want to continue doing is extremely beneficial, not only for your kid, because he's going to be way more flexible as he gets older, but also for you guys. Like, doing hard things is good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's going to be frustrating and everything's going to be way slower if you take them out camping or hunting with you or fishing, but it's totally doable.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's all relative too. You think about people that were going across the plains in wagons, trying to get to Oregon or to California, like having a kid and then crossing the Platte River. Like, okay, yeah, this is pretty easy comparative.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's the parents pretty much dictate how that child's going to grow up and whether it's going to be very difficult to take them camping or hunting or fishing, as opposed to we do it all the time. Our child's extremely flexible and like knows what to expect. This is a normal part of life. Doesn't always have all the cozy necessities, but lives a great life. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's easy to always pick the easy route or the route like we're just going to stay home.
Yeah.
It's easier.
Are you worried about the kids growing up and not liking the outdoors?
No, definitely not. I mean, I'm sure they'll be influenced by me because I am so passionate about hunting and fishing, but I'm going to leave it up to them. I mean, mm-hmm. can't force them to like the same things that I do. If they choose to want to go hunting, then, I mean, I think that's great. Like that's kind of my ultimate, I guess.
Yeah. Right on cue. You got the kids.
That's perfect. Vision for my kids would be that they would want to go do those things with me. But if they choose not to, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
That's totally okay. Like I'd rather have them choose to do that and actually like doing it then force it upon them and have them hate going with dad to go do these things if they don't like it.
Yeah.
And hopefully I'm trying to do more research on how to introduce my kids to these things without, you know, scarring them. Cause there's a lot of things that you don't think about, with kids and even hearing like my wife's story, cause she was kind of scarred by her dad. Regarding hunting when she was a child, just her dad taking bad shots on animals and her being like, oh, he wounded him, you know,
right.
Like that's not a good scenario, as opposed to like, obviously if you're going to have your child there when you're taking an animal's life, making sure that you're as ethical and as confident that you're going to kill the animal because you want that to be ingrained in their mind, not wounding an animal and letting it go.
Yeah.
I even had an experience where my brother-in-law, he had shot a whitetail here in Montana this fall and he had it hanging in his garage and Renna really wanted to go see the deer and I took her out to go see it, but the deer was hanging and had been gutted, you know. And just the visual of a deer hanging from chains in a garage with blood dripping out of its nose, I was just like, she was super scared.
Yeah.
I was like, that was a bad idea. Like, that would be terrifying to almost anyone. You don't know, like, what, is this? Why is that deer hanging here in this gory kind of fashion without knowing, oh, that's what you do with an animal before you cut it up to eat it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, some of my first memories, like, growing up in Kluwak, it was, we moved there when I was 5, so I really don't have many memories of Colorado before we moved up. So the outdoors was just what you did. So even like a couple hours after school, just really, really basic outdoor exposure was just part of life. That's what you did. And then I remember one of the first outdoor adventure memories was we had a trap line and we were checking it, and Dad wanted to follow the river to where it met back up with the highway. He said, you know, just got to be just be aware of your surroundings. So we can go back to the rig, or we can also follow this river because it's going to intersect the highway. So in case there's an emergency or something, you can also go this way because it's going to intersect. Just kind of teaching my brother and I, you know, just being aware of things. And so we were hiking toward the highway, and it was cold and icy, and I wanted to turn around. I was 3 years younger than my brother, so I was kind of pouting, and I was pretty miserable. So finally we turned around and made it back to the vehicle, and I was happy to be warm again. I didn't know this, but Dad had actually fallen through the ice and gotten wet. And somehow I had no clue. I was looking down at my feet, or I don't know what happened there, or I blocked it out. But so, oh man, I'm just thinking, I'm so glad I probably didn't know that. I mean, that had a pretty big impact on me anyway, because it was cold and miserable. And so that I did not like trapping because of that experience. And then same thing out in the ocean. We had this just piece of crap fiberglass boat with an inboard, and it would always break down. So we'd go out and we'd fish for halibut, but we'd just get, you know, we wouldn't brown bomber, you know, just stuff that we didn't even want to keep. And then the engine would break down. And so I hated ocean fishing because of those experiences, but I loved river fishing, and I always wanted to be out in the woods, and we'd just always be out there as much as possible. So I was able to kind of overcome some of those bad things to really, really love being outside. And it's just so refreshing. It's such a great, like, therapeutic way to deal with life later on too, as a stress reducer, as a kind of just get back to normal thing. And it's now, again, as a pending father, think about those sort of things. Just, man, I hope that when we inevitably have some failures, I hope that that the kid still really wants to be outside and can see the value in that.
Oh, absolutely.
So the oldest are twins, and they're 3 and a half?
Yeah.
Have you taken them like camping or anything like that, or fishing, or what's the adventure threshold for 3 and a half year olds?
Yeah, we have taken them camping. We always go a couple times, if not a handful of times every summer. They've kind of been spoiled because we have a little 19-foot camper. So they've had warm nights, which has been crucial. So overall, they've had a great experience with camping. They love camping. And I mean, at some point we'll start doing tent camping and be like, this is actually how you're supposed to do it. But so far they've had a really good experience camping. I haven't taken them hunting yet. They've come fishing with me. We just go to the river, and I'll fish, they'll watch, and they'll just throw rocks. But yeah, we're kind of in like a unique situation now, because we have so many kids that are so little that it was just the twins, we could just throw them in packs, you know, and kind of do whatever. We could take them on hikes, but now that we have 4, you need help to really go do hikes and stuff like that. But we've done hikes to mountain lakes and done some fishing. We've pretty much done it all other than actually going out hunting with Dad. Mm-hmm.
What's the outdoor experience in Montana, and has it changed over the last 10, 15, 20 years? People have talked a lot about increased pressure, you know, climate stuff. You know, how has the experience changed over the last 10, 15 years?
I'd say the experience, I mean, pressure's definitely increased. Darn Yellowstone TV show. No, everyone blames that. But I mean, I think, I think pressure has definitely increased. We have so many tools as hunters that, you know, when it comes to finding a spot to hunt or finding habitat that holds animals you're trying to hunt, or even more so like a non-resident coming to Montana trying to figure out where do I hunt, like there's just so many resources now that make it so easy. I think that's definitely part of the reason why we're seeing added pressure. But also, I don't know, it just feels like, I guess people are hunting more, like more days. As strange as that is, I mean, we still have great opportunity. And if, I mean, if you're willing to put in the work and do the scouting ahead of time and scour maps, I mean, there's still a ton of opportunity. We still have great fishing. I mean, I think there needs to be changes to how Montana manages their wildlife, but overall, there's still a great experience here in Montana. It has changed, but I mean, I think that's probably most places in the West.
Yeah. It's hard to flesh out if it's, or what the reality is compared to the perception, because knowing that everybody has those tools, you just kind of assume that everybody uses those tools and is so motivated, they're actually going to, you know, maximize their opportunities. But, you know, there are pockets of really good deer hunting in Southeast Alaska that are pretty unknown. And that's for a reason. One of the steelhead fishing in Southeast Alaska, there are a couple of rivers that have kind of been, you know, sacrificed to the people who want to come up to Alaska to fish. But there's a lot of really good fishing as long as we keep our mouth shut. So there's, if you don't live here, you can only find what's available. And I think if locals are pretty good about not giving everything up, then you can still have that kind of the local honey hole, and it can be okay. And you don't have to resent the out-of-state hunters, because the out-of-state hunters and the out-of-state anglers and even the tourists here, you know, like that's such a huge part of our economy, because we don't have the forest money that we used to have. It's primarily, you know, people are coming up here for the resources. They're coming up here for the ecotourism, coming up here to look at the glaciers and go on a cruise, and then come up here to rent a boat or go out in a charter. So we can't say we don't want that, because that's our economy. So it's kind of take a breath and do the best you can, work as hard as you can, and just know that you live here and you're going to have way more opportunities than someone who Googled it and paid some money.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, hunting is, yes, one of those pursuits that a lot of people hold pretty close to the heart, but at the same time, just with technology and social media and emphasis on capturing people's hunts, it's hard, man. You want to share the sport with people and protect the resource, which is hard to do without allowing people to have knowledge about it, but at the same time, you know, not, you know, giving up a bunch of secret unknown spots or unknown fisheries. It's pretty controversial, and it's always hard to kind of know, you know, how much do you share and what's worth sharing?
Yeah. I think content makers in general are lumped together as kind of a bad thing because they're advertising, but there's a distinct difference in how, and you can notice this in how someone writes about something and then also how someone makes a film about something. And one of the things I like about your films is you keep the story is the story. It's not a how-to. It's not a fly into here and do this and do this and do this. It definitely has a hunting buddy type appeal rather than you know, here's the steps to do a DIY. And not to say anything bad about the DIY stuff, because there's a place for that and it's helpful and whatnot. But I think there's a good way of telling a good story without having to reveal everything. And people shouldn't feel the need to reveal everything. Just tell a good story. That's the way it's always been done.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm always surprised with some of the filmmakers how much stuff they they include in their videos, which it's completely up to them. But I mean, it's pretty easy to now go on the internet and go on YouTube and find videos that people shoot and have a pretty good idea of where they're at if you are willing to look into it, the details.
Yeah, if you have a starting point and you have Onyx, you can probably figure some things out. But again, that's with a lot of extra time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It is kind of fun. Like I've looked around some of the meat eater films here in Southeast, and like, oh, okay, I know where that is. But rather than like comment on the YouTube and say, oh, I know where that is, that's a great spot, or you should have done this, you know, that's kind of stupid. But and of course, you know, growing up with Dan and knowing Jesse, like kind of guessing some of those areas, and like, okay, cool. But it's just kind of a fun little exercise. There's nothing, you don't need to go blow it up or anything.
Hell yeah. Yeah. Meteor stuff's kind of easy to figure out.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it is what it is. That's such a, here in Ketchikan, there's a lot of people who are, or in the area, just the meat eater is great. It's fun to watch. But then also the, you know, attention, and attention attracts people. And it's, I don't know. It's a double-edged sword. You can't have it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
So what's next on the adventurer's schedule? Do you have another film planned for this year?
Everything's kind of in the works right now. So there's stuff on the table, but it kind of really depends here, like the next month and a half, I would say. A lot of the planning kind of takes place, over the next month and a half. Even more so as like draws for states to come out. It's hard. You plan some stuff. But yeah, I don't have anything on the books yet for 2024. There's just some stuff that's basically up in the air, but not confirmed yet.
Yeah. It's nice to, when you have those resident tags, it's like, well, nothing really on the books yet, just the ordinary stuff that I can do. That's just a good place to be.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of, we're fortunate we have so many opportunities down here with general tags. But yeah, it's always, you're always hopeful that some people draw some tags or you draw a tag that would turn into a cool project.
Do you jump at the opportunities, or do you kind of weigh your options?
Because
I would think that you're fairly in demand. Like people are going to, I'm sure there's a couple of people who are like, yeah, man, I'm going to call Travis if this ends up working out. But like, are you picky, or how does that work?
Yeah, I'm in kind of a unique situation, so. Filmmaking, editing, working on these projects it's not my full-time job. It's just something that I'm passionate about doing. And so I'm pretty picky about what projects I'm going to do. And then also just my time right now is super limited, just with my family and then running my other businesses. Yeah, I'd say I'm pretty picky right now. I just primarily take jobs with Stone Glacier because they're just really good to work with. I love working with those guys. They're super good to me, and they always have just great vision, planning, and everything that like surrounds these projects. So it makes it really fun and easy. And and then it kind of comes down to like, what do I have time for? And I'd say right now, I really only have time for 1 to 3 projects like per fall. Mm-hmm. And that completely depends on if I'm filming it, photographing it, and then am I editing it, editing the film, or if it's just stuff that I need shot. Obviously I can do more of those projects, but yeah, it's all just completely up to what I have time for. I'll be filling, like I fill in some time with some like small editing projects, cause I can just kind of do those whenever. But, yeah, I primarily do just work for Stone Glacier right now.
That's nice. Like getting in with you can get steady work or kind of as much work as you could want, but then you have, people that you know and like to work for, that's got to be pretty nice.
Yeah, it's nice not having, like, I don't have the pressure, like I don't have to do any of like photo film projects. I want to do photo film projects, and I would like to do a lot of them, because for me, like I was talking about, like, it fills my adventure cup going on those hunts and shooting those hunts regardless of I'm not hunting. Like, I love it. Like, it is so fun getting out in the mountains or wherever the hunt takes place and just capturing it. Like, that's fun for me. Like, that's a vacation for me right now. And I'm sure I'll probably start doing more and more as my kids get older. But, yeah, it's really nice to not feel any pressure to actually have to commit to anything that I don't want to. Mm-hmm.
Is there a hunt that you have in your head that if someone asked you to film and edit, you'd be like, absolutely, without question, yes?
Yeah, I mean, a sheep hunt or a brown bear hunt in Alaska, those would definitely be a yes if I could make them work.
Which one first, if it was a sheep or a brown bear, what would you go with?
Probably a sheep hunt. I've never been on a sheep hunt, so I guess I've never been on a brown bear hunt either. But I just like the idea of backpacking the mountains. You're not guaranteed success. We're looking for sheep. It's rugged. Like, the scenery is amazing. That's super appealing, especially from like a filmmaking or photography standpoint. And a brown bear hunt would be up there too, just mm-hmm. because brown bears are sick and there's a danger factor there.
Yeah. Yeah. The sheep hunt is between the federal closures that are ridiculous, and some bad winters, and some of those ranges their populations are a little bit low. It seems mm-hmm. like hopefully it's a dip and they will recover. But some of the alarmist type people are saying that this is like the beginning of the end, or it'll never be what it was. So hopefully there is a nice rebound, mm-hmm. but you can't help but wonder, man, should I have already done that? Or hopefully they recover so you can make it happen. But yeah, that's brown bear hunt seems like something that's going to be an indefinite possibility. But yeah, that sheep hunt, something that's got to happen. And living in Southeast Alaska, you'd think that I'd been on a whole bunch, but Southeast, as you know now, is all islands, and it's hard to get up into the mainland area. You can't just drive there. It's a pretty big logistical issue. And then also the cost is pretty high, but I got some buddies mm-hmm. in Fairbanks, and we're going to, I think in next year, 25 is going to be the sheep year.
Dude. Awesome. Heck yeah. Yeah. I always give Jesse a hard time that he's not sheep or goat hunting every year.
Well, I know, like he got a bunch of sheep when he was, or goats when he was over here, but you know, Prince of Wales is a beautiful island. You know, it's a third mm-hmm. largest island in the US, but you know, just doesn't have goats and doesn't have elk and doesn't have caribou. It's just a paradise for black-tailed deer and black bear, which is pretty nice. Sometimes you don't have those other things, and you don't have to worry about when you're out there, you're calling, you're not going to be calling in a brown bear. You're not going to stumble upon a brown bear. It's super nice to have that, you know, just mind at ease. But yeah, I wanted to get them over here and then and do some goat hunting again. It was a lot of fun this last year. My wife and I both got one, and just an awesome experience.
It's cool you guys have that opportunity there. It's also, yeah, Southeast is, it's almost like living in a different state and then trying to get to sheep country.
Yeah.
You don't need the guide, but you still have to do all the other logistics, you know, to do it. So it's, I understand it's still a lot more that goes into those hunts for a resident, especially when you live in Southeast.
Yeah. My wife and I just have a skiff too, so I know that there is some footage of you guys going around in the skiffs, and it's a little chunky out out there.
It gets a little hairy out there. I mean, I was probably more nervous than any of the local guys, Jesse and Dan, but,
Yeah.
and it's funny because Dan is, he's just a great captain, great boat guy, but his skiff definitely is, got some band-aids on it where you're just like hoping you're not going to be the one that gets stranded out there or you
Yeah.
happen to bail.
Yeah, that's super nice to have like those guys know what they're doing, and so you can feel a definite level of comfort. My wife and I go out, we're checking the weather, and we're like, okay, this is kind of marginal. I would probably trust other people in a bigger boat, but all right, we can get out there today, but in 2 days, what's the weather going to be? And it's kind of exposed here, so I kind of err on the side of caution for sure, especially when you're heading to mountain goat territory in an 18-foot skiff. It's, you need a pretty nice weather window. You want it to be fun too, so.
You don't want to be white knuckling it there and back. And I mean, you hear about stories of people unfortunately getting bad weather and don't make it out in Southeast because it gets pretty gnarly from what I heard.
Yeah, I'd like to not have crazy stories. I'm totally fine with went out there and got a goat and it was fine. Went out there and got a deer, it was fine. I don't need I'd rather read about it. I don't need to live
I mean, it's always a good story if you survive it, but you
it.
would
Exactly.
prefer not to
Yeah.
experience that if you don't have to.
Yeah, I don't want to add to that anthology. Well, what else you got here, man? Coming up on an hour, and I know you got kids to put to bed here on a, well, I would say school night, but they're not in school yet. But what else you got? You got a pitch for the film?
Yeah, I mean, check it out. It's on the Stone Glacier YouTube channel. I know it's a film I worked on, but I would say it's probably one of the most unique black bear films that has been put out. Shoot three bears with a bow, one with a rifle. Three of them were Boone and Crockett. Not that that matters, but it's
Just a
unique that they're
side
all
note.
boars and they're all very large bears, which doesn't really happen much. And really tried to capture the Southeast Alaska experience. And yeah, I think it's worth most people's time if they like hunting.
Yeah, I certainly enjoyed it. So, thanks again, man. Really appreciate you being on here. It was good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
Cool. Thanks.